from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, National Public Radio's Brooke Gladstone, who hosts On the Media, joins us to talk about the media and her recently published graphic book illustrated by Josh Newfield, The Influencing Machine. The book takes us into a history and analysis of the media and tells us why we are the media and the media is us. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Probably the most often quoted line from the famous comic strip Pogo by Walt Kelly was, "We have met the enemy and he is us." To put it in more contemporary terms, it would be, "We've met the enemy and he or she is us." But the media may not be the enemy to Brooke Gladstone. But she's definitely siding with the notion that for ill or good, it is us and not the pincers on our mind and our culture that many make it. Her recent book, The Influencing Machine, a graphic work of history and analysis that she also characterizes as a manifesto, takes us through a whirlwind of facts and observations on the media. Brooke Gladstone is co-host and managing editor of NPR's On the Media, and the book is illustrated by Josh Neufeld, who was a longtime artist for the late Harvey Pekar and the author of A.D., New Orleans After the Deluge, and co-creator of Titans of Finance, True Tales of Money and Business. Brooke Gladstone joins us in studio for the second hour. She served as National Public Radio's media correspondent, Russia reporter, and senior editor of both Weekend Edition and All Things Considered. A former Stanford Knight Fellow, she's recipient of two Peabody Awards, a number of Edward R. Murrow Awards, and the National Press Club's Press Criticism Award. We welcome her to this hour of Forum.
Wow, she's
a long but deserved
like
introduction. No, so all those Bonafides had to be touched on. And dobre utra. Good to see you again.
Dobre utra.
You know, I thought I had a lot of fun with this book because there are a lot of fun facts in it and a lot of fascinating topics that I hope we'll be able to touch on. I thought, I'm going to challenge myself. I'm going to see if I can crunch something deconstructively into three major points. We get the media we deserve. We are the media. And it's pretty much the media always the way it's been.
Right. Well, I think that probably the most surprising one is people often say nowadays that we are teetering on the brink of the collapse of civilization. You know, we've never been less civil. The society has never been more coarse and all of that. And of course, if you look through the history of civilization and if you look through the history of media when it emerged, you will find that we've come to this brink, if it is a brink, again and again and again. And we will again, because these things go in cycles. The culture fragments, the media fragment, the culture coalesces at various points, so do the media. And right now we're in another period of fragmentation, and fragmentation is loud.
And personal assassinations and personal profiles that get into the underside of things have always been a part of what the media has done, as you point out. And the media has always been not exactly welcome to presidents sitting in the Oval Office and chief executives.
The media hate presidents, Democrat or Republican. You find it over and over and over again. And there have always been nasty, nasty campaigns. Politicians have always used the media. The first person to basically coddle the media into reporting things his way by leaking them choice bits of information was George Washington. The first person to leak classified information was Thomas Jefferson in order to undermine George Washington. So this goes way back. You had...
Now, excuse me, you mentioned the first president and the third president. Let's also bring in the second president who gave us the Alien and Sedition Acts.
That's right. And if you go to essentially what amounts to the first real campaign for president, it was a hideously negative one. Somebody in the pay of Jefferson, a commentator, called John Adams said that John Adams had a hideous hermaphroditic character. And people in the pay of John Adams accused Thomas Jefferson of robbing the pensions of widows and of being a half-breed and, you know, all kinds of scurrilous, venomous stuff. And so if you look back at our founding, you will find that this cheap medium, because it was subsidized by the United States. The mail was subsidized so that it could go everywhere quickly. In order to forge a sense of national identity, they needed a press, even if it was a rancorous, cantankerous press. And so what you find is that it was nasty, mean, mendacious, and also brilliant, insightful, profound. You know, you had Hamilton writing horrible things and Hamilton writing brilliant things. You had Thomas Paine arguing for the creation of a national bank. You know, issues of absolute existential importance side by side with so much crap. And what does that sound like to you, Michael?
Well, but speaking of the crap, we didn't have, for example, tweeting about public officials made public. We didn't have the kind of exposure that we have, should we give the word?
Did we not?
Well, I'm just thinking about Gary Hart saying, okay, follow me, that sort of thing. And that really opened a Pandora's box. Now, there was always, as you point out in the book, these kind of scandals about politicians. But with the kind of electronics now and everything, it is a different era.
1801, you could go to the page in the book, somebody reading about Thomas Jefferson's relationship with his slave, Sally Hemings, who has a son named Tom, who bears a striking resemblance to the president himself. Yeah, maybe you didn't have the same kind of distribution then that you had now, but the distribution was pretty darn good. And the same fascination with salacious personal details, you know, really, the technology changed a bit, but not a whole lot more.
I'm remembering, Mama, where's your pa going to the White House? Ha, ha, ha. Presidential campaign. Yeah, things change, but they stay the same in so many ways. But you also have a kind of strong bias here, which is like mine, that the media caters and panders, and it doesn't necessarily, enhance us to see it in ways that are essentially, for lack of a better word, conspiratorial. And yet we have people like Chomsky who have been teaching us or trying to teach us all along that there is this media conglomerate, that it's run by the plutocrats and the corporate, and it's conglomerating even more and more, and therefore its tentacles are extending and it's pretty much interested in its own back.
Well, you know, there are certain tendencies in the media that could be interpreted in conspiratorial ways until you actually work inside it and you realize how chaotic it is. Basically, the reason why, I'll give you a very illustrative example of what I mean. The Chinese, very conspiratorial people. A whole flock of Chinese journalists were once in New York, and I met with them, and they had a lot of tough questions for me about the American media, and it was shortly after the war. Bill Maher had lost his job for, you know, calling the pilots cowards, American pilots, and so forth. And they said, okay, look what's happening here, look what's happening there, look at the coverage. Clearly, the government is intimidating the media. Clearly, the government control the media. Clearly, the media are afraid of the government. And I went, you could not be more wrong. The media are not afraid of the government. They are afraid of their audiences and advertisers. And that's why Bill Maher got the axe back then. And that's the process that creates a timid press. Fundamentally, it's motivated by fear. It wants to track with the public. It doesn't want to get too far ahead of the public. It doesn't want to report things necessarily that the public doesn't want to hear. When it does queasily. But it does it for commercial reasons. And it also does it because the media are people too, and they want to be popular. And the media don't want to be open to charges of bias. So when, as Stephen Colbert once said, to paraphrase him, when a particular position is a prominent one, you know, when a certain point of view has a reality bias, and if you present the point of view because the facts support it without even giving equal time to a specious other side of the issue, you have a kind of a fairness bias which misrepresents the truth and fails to serve the public. There's a lot wrong with the media. But as it fractures, the notion that there's a conspiracy gets weaker and weaker and much harder to defend.
Well, as I said, I quite agree with you. Having worked for a number of years for ABC, the only thing that really mattered was ratings. And the concern was with getting the ratings and thereby selling the products and so forth. But the reality is also that there's a pandering to, well, often what can be described perhaps as the lowest common denominator or a belief in what they call infotainment in the major media, which seems to give rise to the notion that you have to give people what they want. And if that means that there's a war in Afghanistan or there's a president in Yemen who may be stepping down or whatever, well, we've got Anthony Weiner. Let's go with that. That's what people want.
Right. But I think part of the problem here is that we're still thinking in terms of mainstream media. I mean, even as we sit here having this conversation, Michael, mainstream media is fraying at the edges. The business model is no longer really working. There's no longer the need to coalesce enormous audiences to support an incredibly expensive technology, which is what television was. The whole notion of objectivity was it was an aberration in American media and, in fact, in global media. It occurred because there was a convergence of a politics, that was to say Cold War politics, that demanded conformity and marginalized outsiders, and the emergence of a technology television that required audiences of unprecedented size to support the advertising, to support the programming. So both signed on to this notion of consensus reporting. They created a big middle. It was bland. It was white, Christian, didn't have accents or vowels at the end of the names. You didn't see, it was middle class and middle American, and it was so complete that there was actually the possibility for a news anchor to say at the end of a broadcast, and that's the way it is.
And boy, some Americans continue to be nostalgic for that's the way it was with Walter Cronkite.
Right.
Uncle Walter was when news was really delivered in the way it should have been and all that. We're talking, by the way, with Brooke Gladstone, who is co-host of On the Media, and whose new book is The Influencing Machine. I want to get into that title in a moment because, believe it or not, it's from Freud, one of Freud's acolytes. But first, you mentioned the fairness bias, and let me go right to that because the business model may not be working in the mass media, but it seems to be working here. In fact, I want to announce this because I think it's really good news and I'm heralding it. We now have we being KQED Radio, the leading numbers in terms of Arbitron, in terms of ratings and so forth of any listeners per quarter hour of any radio station in the Bay Area, which is unusual for a public radio station, even one that's as good as this. But what strikes me about the fairness bias is in public radio, there has always been – it's very different than the business model you were talking about. There's always been this need for objectivity too, so that, as you point out, you really need to put on an anti-global warming person. Or as Deborah Lipstadt and others have said, you're talking about the Holocaust. You need to have a Holocaust denier. I mean, it gets into this kind of unfathomably beyond understanding notion that there is two sides to everything. But I think NPR still kind of hews to that, don't they?
Well, I want to address that question, but I want to go back to a point that I didn't get to finish that relates directly to your good news about this radio station. Because you had asked, people think they have to pander and to give people what they want, and what they want is Anthony Weiner. We, public radio has shown, and our station in New York is doing really quite well with regard to the rest of the media as well, is that you give the public what you think is best, and the public will find you if you aren't mass-producing for a mass audience. If you needed to coalesce the enormous audience that television needed, you might get more listeners if you were talking about Anthony Weiner. Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. But you can be the largest station because radio is fragmented. And so you can get the biggest chunk because there are all these fragments of people getting what they want. This is a cheaper technology, and it works better in this age. Digital technology is cheaper still. Getting to your
point. We get to my point, but I need to insert something.
Sorry.
Because it's one of the also best pieces of news that people love to hear, especially people who are fans of National Public Radio or of KQED. That NPR has more listeners than, and this is a sign maybe of the healthier side of civilization, he says immodestly, where public broadcasting is concerned, has more listeners than the combined viewers of Fox, CNN and MSNBC.
It's awesome. You know, it's really...
Of course, a big spike after 9/11, but nevertheless, there it is.
That's true. And it's really not surprising. The point is that you can produce better programming if you aren't imagining your audience to be a big, bland, lumpen dumbhead.
Or come on, let's be fair about this too. If you don't have commercials every few minutes.
Well, that's true. But I'm just saying that the biggest mistake people make is by programming down to what they think the public wants rather than, you know, programming what you want to hear. I don't think that I'm programming what the public needs. I hope I'm not that arrogant. I just program about what I'm interested in because somebody gave me the chance. They gave me the microphone, something that amazes me daily, frankly, but they did. So I program the very best I can for somebody who is kind of like me. And that's the best that
Aren't
I can do.
Aren't you being modest about your amazement? But
no, I'm not. I'm really not. I'm that is absolutely honest.
You're really humble.
It still strikes me as a miracle.
Oh, come on. You're a professional broadcaster. You've been in the game a long time, and you're a damn good one. But let's go back to the point I raised about this fairness bias. It does afflict public broadcasting, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I do think that there's a tendency for all mainstream media to quail in the face of the charge that they are left-wing, which was something that really began in earnest in the Nixon administration and has proceeded ever since. It's something that's almost a reflex now, a flinch. And fairness bias is one of the most pernicious biases because it's used to counter the charge of bias. And you saw it, you know, you can see it in many early discussions of global warming. It's not so bad as it used to be, but it used to be a lot of, you know, equal time, mathematically equal time, appointed to the vast consensus of scientific opinion versus a few outliers. And in order to make it appear to be a balanced piece, they provided an unbalanced version of the truth, the producers and reporters of those pieces. You see it with evolution discussions sometimes. You saw it with the John Kerry Veterans for Truth thing. What was the name of that organization?
Swift Boats.
Yeah, the Swift Boaters. They gave, you know, their charges were quickly debunked. The debunked was basically snowed under. And then they were back again, equal voices, because it was a political issue during a campaign. And in order to be scrupulously fair, they presented an incredibly inaccurate and unfair perspective on, you know, what were, you know, verifiable facts.
It's like equal time to birthers, right? I mean, it's that sort of notion we're talking to Brooke Gladstone, who's the author of The Influence, The Influencing Machine, illustrated by Josh Neufeld. It is, well, a cartoon book in some ways.
It's a comic book.
It's a graphic book featuring avatars of Brooke Gladstone. There she is deciding, for example, during colonial times on the jury about things that it took England more of a century later to decide. Let me go right to the heart, though, of this title, because I said I wanted to get some glossing from you on it. There was a patient of someone who was a follower of Freud's, a schizophrenic patient, a woman patient, and she thought that she was being influenced by this machine. So there you go. The media becomes that metaphor becomes the media.
That's right. And it works in so many ways. Her name was Natalia A. Freud's acolyte, in this case, was a young man named Victor Tausk, who noticed that there was, throughout the literature of psychiatry, a tendency in schizophrenics to project the parts of themselves that they couldn't acknowledge, sexual feelings, psychological, psychosomatic, physical conditions, obsessions, behaviors, onto a device, an outside locus of control, generally using whatever the new technology of the day was. But that wasn't even the first case. He's the one who gave it the name, the syndrome of the influencing machine in schizophrenia. But 100 years earlier, man after the French Revolution believed that he was being controlled by a machine operated by nefarious people, conspirators, using what was then the new science of gases to drive Britain to war with France. Every single time there is a new technology, it is picked up by a schizophrenic, somebody mentally ill, as the basis for a device operated by evildoers to force one to do things that one's better nature wouldn't do. In other words, to excite one's demons and suppress one's better angels.
And every time there's a war, the media tends to really catapult into all kinds of different directions, as you point out in your book.
Well, you
know, become a problem, of course, for those in power.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the thing is that there are a series of biases to the media, of the media, that I outline in the book, seven of them. Somebody called them the seven deadly sins. But and political bias isn't among them. It's so obvious. It's so easy.
Excuse me, Isabel Allende said there are only two interesting sins from the seven deadly, sloth and lust and gluttony.
Yes. And if that were only more of a plague in our profession, it would be more fun, wouldn't it? But, you know, we have things like the commercial bias. News has to be new. We have visual bias. We have, let's see, what else do I have in there? The narrative bias, the bad news bias, the access bias. All of these biases that you see throughout journalism really get full expression in during wartime. Commercial bias means that just a series of new events without any context, the new car bomb, the new IED. Bad news bias makes us think the world is scarier than it is. Well, war is just the story of bad news. Narrative bias, you have stories that are pushed into a narrative box, a frame with a beginning, middle, and end, and that creates all kinds of inaccuracies, like the story of Jessica Lynch, for instance. The one bias that doesn't get a workout during war, however, is fairness bias, because there's never two sides in the war.
You're moving historically throughout this book. In fact, as you said, well, it began with Julius Caesar, even before that. And
invention of the alphabet.
Invention of the alphabet, right.
Actually, I go back to cavemen one point.
That's true. And in a sense, seeing the whole trajectory of the media, taking us through all these kind of fascinating historical periods, suppression of speech up to the modern day and right up through Joe McCarthy and into the present and all that. But you seem to be optimistic on the whole. You seem to think we're evolving rather than devolving.
I believe we are. I absolutely believe we are. And partly I'm optimistic because my biggest fear in life is not the collapse of civilization. It's boredom. I flee from boredom. And I'm very excited by the time we're in. I understand why it's so discomforting for people. As Douglas Adams, the author of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, said, any kind of technology that you grew up with seems right and in the natural order of things. Anything that happens before the age of 35 seems exciting and new, and anything that happens after that seems unnatural and augurs the apocalypse.
Well, but as you point out, we're being rewired. Our neuroscience seems to attest that we are being rewired. So why be optimistic about this rewiring when we don't know where it's all leading?
Ah, because that also has always been the case. Anthropologists have determined that our brains didn't get big and we didn't become bipedal and then we picked up a club. What happened is that the first humans that picked up a club lived longer, and you could pick up a club better if you walked on 2 feet. Your teeth could get smaller. Your brain could get bigger. Your body's changed because of your tools. We know people make tools, but tools make people. Tools changed humans. Tools always do, and they are changing them now. They are rewiring us now. And like it or not, that is the future. Do you want to go back to Cro-Magnon, ma'am? I don't. I don't know what the future is going to bring. But like Douglas Adams says, just because it's different doesn't mean we have to panic.
Now, you're quoting Douglas Adams when you're talking about our having 2 feet and being bipeds. It reminds, I think it was Voltaire or Rousseau who said, man is a biped without feathers. Kind of puts things in a certain context. We're talking about the whole context of the media with Brooke Gladstone, who is co-host of On the Media. And it's a visionary and opinionated work of graphic nonfiction on the media and its discontents. Taken again from Freud, civilization is discontents. My friend Harvey Peskin used to say that it should be called Civilization as Discotheques. The Influencing Machine is the book. Your calls are welcome. Please feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, you can join us now, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. We'll return. We'll hear from you. Talking about the media with Brooke Gladstone, I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Brooke Gladstone this hour, author of a new book, which is graphic, cartoon, The Influencing Machine, illustrated by Josh Neufeld. And it's really all about the history of the media and also an analysis of the media and so many of the good things you get when you listen to On the Media, the public radio program that she co-hosts and is an editor of, host and managing editor of. And she'll be actually at Booksmith in San Francisco tonight at 7:30 if you'd like to meet her. Fans of Brooke Gladstone should know, 7:30 this evening at the Booksmith in the Haight. And you can join us now if you have something you'd like to add to this conversation, or for that matter, take away from it. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Asking questions like, how is the media changing in your view? Is it a monolith? We used to have these debates with, I remember, Phil Bronstein and Norman Solomon got at it head-to-head, Norman suggesting a monolithic quality to the media and corporate tentacles sort of spreading into everything and many stories that seem to vivify that. And Phil Bronstein, former editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, disagreeing rather stridently. How much does the media really control our lives? How much does it dictate to our culture? These are very important, vital questions, and certainly many of you have some opinions, so feel free to share them. Again, you can join us by phone, toll-free at 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. And I'm looking at Brooke's book here for a moment, and here is the character of Brooke Gladstone, who appears throughout in different forms in the Josh Neufeld illustrations, writing on a tablet and listening to the phone and saying, polls would seem to be the scientific way to chart consensus, but of course, wording changes everything. Example, a January 2003 poll. When people were asked whether they would favor or oppose taking military action in Iraq to end Saddam Hussein's rule, 68% favored it. But when pollsters added the clause, quote, even if it meant that U.S. forces might suffer thousands of casualties, end of quote, only 43% favored it. And boy, that has everything to say about how things are framed. I mean, not only in terms of polling, but in terms of, well, what the media presents and disseminates.
Right. And polls are a particularly sticky wicket because everything has to do with how it's framed. In fact, I talked to somebody who'd worked for many years at the Gallup poll who said that because if you ever wonder why polls swing so wildly before an election, it's because they deliberately ask the wrong question. And they ask the wrong question because they're mostly hired by news outlets, and news outlets need news. And if they ask the right question, it wouldn't be news. The wrong question they ask is, who would you vote for president if the election were happening right now? Then somebody gives an answer and everybody picks something, right? And so that's a headline. But if you asked, who are you going to vote for president? 40, 50% would say, I haven't decided yet. And that's not news. And so they don't ask that question, although that's the reality. So instead you get the opportunity for luscious headlines of massive swings in the public mind because they're being asked to pick. Do you want the red or the blue? They don't have to be convicted about it. They're only asked if it were happening right now. It's a hypothetical. And that's the sort of thing that everybody faces every single election cycle. Look for this election cycle. It's just a bunch of nonsense.
Everybody also faces the constant streaming below and cable news and keeping up with the latest kidnapping or whatever sensational bleeds it leads and all that. And yet you see things evolving, and it prompts me to, and getting more optimistic about how they're evolving, the whole trajectory of things, which prompts me to ask you just what you feel about the fact that, well, by some people's lights, the bloggers and the citizen journalists are replacing or supplanting the professionals or playing a more key role than the professionals. And that's good.
Well, you know what? It's just more speech. It's just moving towards more and more speech. Once I was on some PBS show and Brian Gumbel asked me to give a grade to the media, talk about a monolithic approach to the media. And I said, okay, A, B, C, D, and F. And I think that the same is true today. I mean, you can't automatically believe that because somebody isn't getting paid to do reporting that they're necessarily worse than someone who is being paid. I mean, if you look at the Arab Spring, most of the on-the-ground reporting was done by non-professionals, by bloggers, and that reporting was incalculably better than the deceptive reporting that was being done by their mainstream press, governments are able to get at the press much more quickly than they can at individuals. Institutions can be very much more vulnerable.
Well, it depends where you are. In Iran,
that's
if you're
right.
an individual, you're going to be a lot more vulnerable.
Well, yeah, but you can hide. You know, yes, you are. If you get caught, you are very, very vulnerable. But the institutions don't put themselves in harm's way, so they aren't going to get attacked.
Let's bring our listeners into this conversation. And Greg, we'll begin with you. Join us. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael. And good morning, Brooke Gladstone. I highly enjoy listening to OTM.
Thank you.
Yes, great. So my question is how the media treats conspiracies as though they're all equal. We've got this notion of birthers out there, and I really think that's kind of to inoculate the public as to what a conspiracy is. Now, when I look at events such as September 11th, which your program has covered, I'd ask you to not run from this question when I pose to you that we're skeptical about media organizations like you guys, because in New York City on September 11th, three buildings fell and two planes hit them, and World Trade Center 7 was the first building to fall in the history of humanity due to fire. So we're skeptical as to the perspective that mainstream media, and I would include you, and National Public Radio in that, we're skeptical because when I ask this question, I think you're going to run from it. How did that third building come down if supposedly planes brought them
you
down?
You know, we've spent so much time ad nauseum on this, and this isn't what you said you wanted to talk about, so I'm going to move on here. But Brooke Gladstone, we do hear from people who still have strong opinions about something behind 9/11 that had nothing to do with
mm-hmm.
Al-Qaeda,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure you hear them. And
absolutely. There, you know, it is very possible nowadays to present a great and convincing tapestry of bogus facts and create a watertight argument from them. We have that about people who from people who believe we never walked on the moon, that we attacked ourselves in 9/11. There's that famous film that millions have seen on the internet, put together by a couple of college students, that seemed to prove that there was a missile on the plane. Oh, no, it was there was an explosion that was already set, and that it was a government explosion. This is what Farhad Manjoo calls the photoshopification of culture. It's very easy to manipulate digital material, extremely easy.
But you know, what was a real catalyst to a lot of this was the Zapruder film. I mean, there were many people who began to doubt the official renditions of what happened
in
the
Kennedy assassination. Well, that's one of the conspiracies, I agree.
Yeah.
But the Zapruder film, no one thinks it was faked.
No, exactly my point, though. I mean, you could talk about photoshopping
mm-hmm.
now, but in those days, of course, there was no
mm-hmm.
photoshopping.
Yeah, but there is one thing about conspiracy theories that must give one pause, which is that usually they emerge out of a vacuum. It's because people aren't given enough complete open information. That leaves a lot of space to be filled by speculation and by, you know, putting together fact A with fact B, something that, you know, Glenn Beck would do, hooking, you know, Jane Fonda to, you know, whatever his complex constellation of loose associations he would create.
I think it's mainly George Soros for, for Glenn Beck, but let's move on to more of our callers mm-hmm. here, and we'll welcome Zach, you're our next caller. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on your show. I really enjoy it. I was wondering, to what degree is the general public responsible for being more skeptical of what we're hearing in mainstream media? Are we being too passive?
I love this question. Thank you so much for it. Here's the thing, is that back in the days of the penny press, when we had a lot of fragmented opinions, also some great reporting, it was also the time of the muckrakers, but a lot of, you know, pretty mendacious reporting, the public would consume these fragments with a high degree of skepticism. They knew exactly what they were consuming. We're in a period of transition now. We are going back to a period of transition, of fragmentation, moving away from the period of consensus journalism. A lot of that reporting is brilliant. A lot of that reporting is awful. And yes, it is much more incumbent on the public to approach all of these things with skepticism. But you have something that people in the days of the penny press didn't have, and that is the ability to frequently access primary documents, to double and triple check facts with a variety of credible organizations. In other words, to see if a reporter is credible by dogging his tracks on a particular story that matters a great deal to you. People say that nowadays, in the day of links, transparency is the new objectivity. And that's where your trust in a particular news outlet should come from. Do a little bit of checking, sort of test out what you've just read on a story or an issue that you really care about, and then begin to collect a bunch of trustworthy news outlets.
But here we get to one of the other seven deadly sins, sloth. I mean, too many people are indolent when it comes to doing that kind of checking. And I'll tell you, I don't have the time. I mean, I've told people to check facts in many instances, and I often get that response.
Right, and I totally understand that. And our parents never had to pick their own pension plans, and our parents never had to pick their own health plans, or paper or plastic, or mastectomy or lumpectomy, or all the choices that we have now. This is a caveat emptor world. You have to make these choices. And if you don't, then you pay the consequences.
I like the sound of that. A caviar emptor world. It should be a movie or a song. Mm-hmm. Here's Frank from Berkeley who says, we broadcasters, should be more like BBC correspondents. Two who readily come to mind are Owen Bennett Jones and Claire Balderson. If and when the interview subject replies, he puts REP/LEIS, with BS, the correspondent gets in his or her face with veracity-affirming questions. If an NPR correspondent tries that, he or she faces a barrage of criticism of political bias. That charge usually includes a charge of liberal bias because unvarnished reality presentation is, for inexplicable reasons, regarded by the right as something liberal.
Now, that's the Colbert quote that I was trying to avoid. Everybody knows that reality has a well-known liberal bias. I think he said at a White House correspondents' dinner. I just completely agree with the person who wrote that email. I absolutely believe that the role of the journalist is to be the audience surrogate. They're privileged to be in a position to ask questions that other people don't get to ask. And if you allow yourself to get brushed off in order to appear civil and fair, you're committing a kind of fairness bias yet again. You aren't fulfilling your jobs. I think that the BBC model is very good. There are a couple of reasons why we don't get to do that, because our segments here are frequently so short, a politician can just run out the clock on a question without ever answering it, unless the correspondent is willing to interrupt.
Well, there's a tough one there, because when I interrupt, and I do, and sometimes get tough with,
you mean like just
with
now?
Politicians. Yeah, like just now, exactly. Thank you. I'll get criticized for being politically biased. Not with you, obviously.
Right. No, obviously not with me. You will get criticized for it. And I guess my response to that would be tough noogies.
Well, but on the other hand, if I let particularly a politician speak and say, you know, this is the marketplace of ideas, let these ideas go forth, let the listener decide, caveat emptor and so forth, I'll get criticized for not being tough enough.
Right. Well, how does the listener decide if they're only getting one side? I mean, you have to push back.
Well, sometimes what happens is you think that the politician that you're talking to is going to cover something from, say, that's much more content-oriented or it doesn't necessarily present a political bias. And then you get to the realization that this is political bias.
Yeah, I guess what you have to do then is, and you're lucky in your show because you can just decide to go longer, right? I mean, if somebody is giving
sometimes
you the runaround, right, I know. But if somebody's giving you the runaround, you can interrupt, you can go longer. On my show, it's when we get a politician on, I can at least ask him the same question 35 times, cut out the 30 times in between, and wear them down and get an answer. Hear the BBC do that on the air because those shows are live.
They are edited, and it makes a great deal of difference. I mean, I'm not saying I want the show to be edited. I like walking the tightrope and doing it live without any editing. But boy, that would make a difference in terms of what you're talking about. We'll go to more calls, and we'll go to Sunnyvale. Shiv, join us. You're on.
Hi, Michael. Good morning. I first of all apologize because I'm new to this country and I don't know the achievements of your guest. And I don't mean to misconstrue what she said, but she used the word "I" when she said how she would report on a story. And I would like to know how important it is for a newscaster to remove the "I" or "my views" or "my opinion" when he or she tries to report a story so that they can actually answer the questions of the listeners as opposed to their own questions on the topic. And I take my answer on the air.
Okay, thank you for the call.
Okay. Well, obviously, we're talking about my book and my views on the media, so naturally, I'm going to be using the personal pronoun quite a lot. When I am approaching an interviewer, I am assuming and that I am approximating the kinds of questions that the listeners want. I trust that I have a certain affinity with the listeners. Otherwise, I think I would have been removed. The show has gotten pretty popular. It grows every time. And I think it's partly because we do ask those hard questions. I don't make the interviews about me, if that's what the caller is suggesting, because I think that's a big waste of time for the listener.
But you've just given an answer to your question before about how long have you lasted and why, and your humility, your affinity with the listeners must be...
It's working out. It's working out. I can only hope that I am asking the kinds of questions that the listener wants to hear. Since I don't have a crystal ball or a telepathic link, I have to assume that we have the same kind of curiosity, and I apply that curiosity to the guest.
And since listeners are now thinking Michael was rude for interrupting you, should I apologize formally for interrupting you?
Hell no.
All right, good. Actually, very important question. Why does Bob Garfield pause on Brooke's name at the end? The inside joke is a mystery. Please explain why Bob Garfield says, edited by Brooke.
That is the most common question we ever get. Here's the thing, is that back when I was the editor of All Things Considered, Bob used to do these kind of bizarro Charles Kuralt going around the country and, you know, do pieces on people who freeze-dried their pets and things like that. And, you know, because he was dealing with people who had unusual pursuits and interests and were quirky and eccentric, he always had to walk a line, so he didn't seem to be making fun of these people. And I got his humor, and he was really happy about that. But sometimes I thought his humor would get a little mean, and I would pull it back in the editing process. And he always agreed with me in the end, but we have a legacy of me editing Bob. And in that pause is a kind of rueful resignation / admiration / I wish I could crush her like a bug kind of feeling, all combined in there with affection. And that's what that pause means.
Let me read a couple of emails. This is Lee in Palo Alto. Says, the worst sin I see committed on political talk shows is hosts allowing aggressive right-wing guests to interrupt centrist and left-wing guests constantly so that the liberals never get to complete a thought. And, of course, if a host doesn't permit this, the host, the program, the network, and its advertisers get an avalanche of phone calls, emails, and letters marshaled by right-wing websites. Next is the host tossing nothing but softballs to guests with similar political leanings. And by the way, Deborah Tannen's book is one I would also recommend, which I've mentioned before on this program, The Argumentative Culture, because when you see these programs where people are just yelling and you're not really hearing anything, that's it may reflect our culture, unfortunately, but it's something that we have to be mindful of, and we are on public radio. And here's a listener who says, so the media panders to the consumer, but the consumer relies on the media to a great extent to make sense of the world. Thus, our prejudices and misconceptions are reinforced, and the biases of the media come to be reflected in the views of the consumer. Just because this isn't new and a product of consumer demand doesn't mean that we don't need to complain and criticize and strive to improve the system that we rely on for information.
That's exactly the conclusion I come to in the book. I'm just saying that the moral of that story is that never has the consumer had more power than it has right now to change the media to better reflect its priorities, values, and concerns. And by media, I mean any media you like, because the mainstream media used to be a, you know, one or two or three too many kind of thing. And now, basically, it's the many who produce their own main streams of media. So you choose the stuff that you like the people who have chosen public radio, for instance, and public radio is doing incredibly well in this environment. That's because people are choosing it, and it didn't try and choose them necessarily. And
caveat emptor, but emptor be vigilant and emptor be activist.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, trust but verify, as Reagan said, and, you know, the price of freedom is eternal isn't it eternal
vigilance? That was Goldwater,
vigilance.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, that was vigilance. Actually, I think that was Jefferson. And then there was, you know, All Presidents Lie. I think that was I.F. Stone.
Here's Jack, who says, Brooke, what do you think about the encroachment of corporate influences seen through increasing ubiquitous mobile media like smartphones and pads? Are these devices more than pocketable billboards?
Yes, they are more than pocketable billboards. But yes, I am concerned about the fact that the wide and woolly open internet is getting constrained. Again, this has to do with consumer behavior. Consumers don't want to negotiate a wild and woolly internet. They would like to have their access to the cyberspace mediated. That's why many of these tools are so popular. It's really, again, up to every individual to seek information outside of their comfort zone. It is hard to defeat the echo chamber. We are wired to flock together. It's called homophily. We are, you know, we can engineer our media lives so that we never encounter accidental information, a fact that we wouldn't embrace, or an opinion that threatens our view of the world. We can live in those bubbles or we can go outside of them. But that really is hard. I spend a lot of time in the book on human cognition, how we process information, how we resist it, whether or not rationality really is applied to our decisions or whether they come from another place in our bodies and our brains. And all of this works very, very strongly on how media are created and consumed and selected. And the more we know about ourselves, the better we can inform ourselves. And after all, you know, when it comes to information, we are what we eat.
Well, you also come off as somewhat of a determinist. I mean, that, you know, we are what we are, and thinking that the media is going to change us to any great extent when the media reflects us, when the media is our mirror rather than this control over us, is maybe even foolhardy.
No, I'm not a determinist. I mean, I really feel we have the capacity to change the way that we consume media to some degree, not necessarily defeat our wiring or defeat our biology when it comes to consuming information. But, you know, the conscious life is the one that's worth living. It just as one, you know, in a time when people write down every single thing they eat as a way to control their diet, you know, you can consciously consume information. And yeah, it is harder. It is harder. This is a very complicated world we live in. But think of what you get for the effort.
Well, I've got a listener in an email and a listener on the line here who raised similar questions. I'm just going to collate these because this is Andres, who says, why is it that if a volcano erupts or there is some bad weather, some even mild political social event in Europe or Asia, the media is all over that? However, if the same event occurs in South America, Australia, New Zealand, mostly the southern hemisphere, there's little or no coverage. In fact, elections in Peru, a volcano going wild in southern Chile or Argentina, terrible weather and floods, et cetera, seem as if they were not there at all. What's the real reason for the almost absolute lack of news coverage? And I say I collate this with your call, Noah, because you're raising this about Africa, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I recently went to Africa and realize that there is a plethora of really interesting news that's not being covered at all over here. And all you hear about is obviously genocide and natural disasters. So, yeah, what's the deal with that, you think?
Regional bias. It exists, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that there is a failure to explain the stakes for these stories. I mean, there's a failure to recognize the stakes. There is a sense that, you know, if American interest doesn't appear to be directly involved, it isn't as interesting. There isn't as much of an affinity for Africa because this is principally a European, you know, there's, you know, why beat around the bush? A certain amount of racism. These class, some of these stories aren't interesting because they aren't happening to Europeans.
I was in elementary school before you, but they used to call Africa the Dark Continent. It was like it didn't exist.
Really. Right. Yeah. You know, so there certainly is all of that. But the information, you know, is available. And that's what I mean is that if you, you know, want information about Africa, then you can easily find information about Africa, even if you don't find it in mainstream American news outlets. I agree that there is America is a mysterious island nation that seems to regard other the rest of the world is as kind of beside the point unless we have a particular affinity. You know, we care about what happens in Paris because we like to go there. You know, we don't spend a whole lot of time in Zimbabwe. And so, you know, it seems to fall off the map. We don't understand our interconnections there. But this is a much more global world. And when there is unemployment in the Middle East, it affects us. When there is an epidemic in Africa, it affects us. And, you know, I think increasingly, as we become more interconnected, we will understand how, you know, every corner of the world has an impact on our lives here.
So funny to hear you call America an island nation, having just come back from Cuba a few weeks ago, which is a real island nation. But I talk about media that doesn't get disseminated. We're going to try to get some more of your calls on. Richard, join us. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, thanks for taking my call, and congratulations to KQED for being in the lead in the Bay Area market. That's where I'm from originally. But my point was just to concur with the email in Berkeley and to pose the question, because I don't watch any news on cable or whatnot. Basically, I listen to NPR and watch some public television. How can we further undo this kind of reporting an untrue story in the name of equal positions, especially since 9/11 with the war and now the three wars that we're fighting? I stopped watching Charlie Rose for this very reason, because I can't sit and watch somebody talk in measured tones about troop size and deployments and whatnot, as opposed to why are we there? And so just speaking more to the point, if you would, about this propensity to give an untrue story in the name of having two sides speak on a matter.
Sometimes what you hear is a primal scream in the form of a question. And I think that's what I'm hearing is a great deal of frustration. The media are, you know, not reflecting what appear to be, you know, and I don't disagree with you, but, you know, they're, you know, your values are offended by the kind of cold and clinical treatment of things like troop deployments that you hear in discussions on, say, Charlie Rose. I really think that kind of media, all media, individual things are getting less and less dominant. And it's how you consume media that makes the difference. And, you know, yeah, write your letters. Show that you're angry if you're angry and you want to watch that program, the ones that you care about. But fundamentally, it's up to you.
Good note to end on. The Influencing Machine by Brooke Letstone, co-host of On the Media. Thank you so much for being with us. You can meet her tonight, 7:30 at the Booksmith in San Francisco. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, our interns, Mojan Rastegar, Nathan Falk, Arjun Singh, Katie Fleeman, and Natalie Rothfels. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.